Hello, Diane. How are you?
I'm awesome. How are you, Jeff? What a pleasure.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice to see you.
Good to see you too.
Diane, first of all, thank you for talking to me. I believe numerous roles that you play. Today, I want to speak with you in the capacity you play as someone who facilitates transformational groups, because that's becoming more something that's occurring in the group of people that I work with. There seems to be increasing interest in transformational groups and the power of transformational groups. And I know that this is something you've been working with for years. And I'm really excited to talk to you because I feel like there's so much people could learn, could know, could benefit from, that I think your experience will help us with. But maybe to start, I would love to hear you speak a little bit about just transformational groups. I think that's a term I think I've heard you use. What is a transformational group? What's the value of transformational groups? What are we actually talking about?
I'd like to open the discussion of my relationship to transformations in a group setting, by just giving your audience a little bit of background. So my professional life, I was and am a mediator and a facilitator, and I'm also a lifelong meditator. I started in my very early 20s, and I'm, approaching 70 now. It only occurred to me recently that mediate and meditate have the same root word, and that I should think about that. And that really, essentially, what it means is to discover or to realize, our deeper commonality. And in mediation, of course, to get a set of agreements or make deals, depending. And so meditation has this capacity to really open us to our fundamental sameness. And that's a big theme for me in my work. And then mediation helps us with the sameness of our humanity and our overlapping interests and shared goals and how to accomplish those. And I think that both you and I were influenced by Ken Wilber's work, both in terms of his ideas regarding evolutionary consciousness, but also the evolution of consciousness. And also adult development and what that means. And so I think the additional dimension that becomes important in transformation is this notion that we evolve. So we work within a context in which our sameness is highly cultivated, and that our energy, our ability to sustain attention, our willingness to grow, a bunch of shared values are the basis of a transformational group. And that the individual itself evolves, and so does the group. Now, one place where I differ from other transformational work is I put a very powerful emphasis on how to include our differences. Sometimes people's approach is to cultivate sameness so that we almost become like a whole-on, like a part whole. The group is a part whole. But I accept Ken Wilber's view that we're social holons, and so there's always this freely functioning individuality, and yet we're held together by the moment. We're held together by our values. We're held together by our intentionality. We're held together by our love of one another and our relationships. But if we don't learn how to work with difference properly, we cannot grow and evolve and transform individually or collectively. And for me, that's where I feel a lot of weakness sets in terms of how we work with groups. And because sameness and difference do very, very different things in the body. And a lot of what happens within transformational settings is embodied work, in the sense that when we're functioning together and we experience something like group flow, where we're in a space of effortlessness, we're in a space of timelessness, where whatever we're engaged with, we could do for hours, for example. And selflessness is the it naturally arises, that there isn't a lot of emphasis on self-identity, whether you're being seen and heard, and how much you're valued, and how do you get attention in the room, all the preoccupations of the self drop away. So we can have a very powerful experience of oneness, if you will, and function really as a whole on, as a social whole on, in a very fluid way. But when differences arise, because difference begins as an excitement in the nervous system, and I like to remind the people that I work with that anything we've ever learned, we've learned because of the encounter with the difference, with something we didn't know, with something that was not me, something, essentially foreign, if you will. And that by making relationship to that and bringing it into ourselves, it actually becomes us. So you can use the analogy, since the Olympics just occurred, if you're an athlete that, you've never performed a jump before, and you're young, let's say you're like six or something, but you've seen this possibility, and then you're able to move, to get to know it. And as you get to know it, you bring it in closer, and then you make some attempts, and you start to learn, like, how is it executed? And then pretty soon it is me, after enough of, exchanging with this possibility and learning about it in the body and taking risks, then it becomes us. But the challenge is that while difference is exciting to us and it is absolutely essential to our growth and our transformation, it very easily in the context of groups becomes a threat. So that, for example, in many of the circles that we're in now, there's an emphasis on racial justice, for example, gender relations, we can use the woke theme if we would like to. And that even though everyone may be organized around the same value, of course, we want everyone to be treated equally. I mean, how could we not, right? When we start to talk about it, a lot of the old trauma, the one up, the one down, the struggle, it enters the room. And what that does to our nervous systems is we might cognitively be able to stay present, and even with our awareness, stay present. But there's another part of us that it's embodied and preconscious is literally just formulating ways to escape. So when difference becomes threat, learning stops and transformation stops. So for me, learning how to work with a body that is, we can use the word that people use now as triggered. Basically, the amygdala is signaling the brain to drip stress hormones into our system. How is it that we can continue to communicate, to cultivate sameness, and really almost discover that it's the sensations that keep us from being able to do what we need to do? It isn't the ideas, it's the embodied sensations. So I spend a lot of time on that.
That's very interesting. And one thing that you triggered in me is there's a book called Imagine. It shares some findings of a study that was done. It's a study on creativity, and they looked at musicals, Broadway musicals, because what they said is a Broadway musical involves so many different kinds of creative people to bring the whole thing together. And they wanted to see, well, what makes a Broadway musical successful? What they found is some musicals are groups of people who have worked together on different shows over time, and they're now coming together for a new show. Other musicals are people who are brand have never worked together. This is going to be their first. And what they found is that those two extremes tend to not work very well. And what works perfectly is when you have some people that have worked together and therefore know each other and have a shared commonality, but there's also enough people that have never worked with them that they're introducing novelty into the mix. And those tend to be the shows that work the best. And I thought it perfectly reflects things I've heard that you talk about in relationship to coherence and differentiation and the need for there to be a balance.
I like that you use an analogy to an art form, because really what we're talking about in terms of transformation is the art of transformation. There isn't a fixed method. What there are decisions and conditions that get created so that the creative and transformative emergence can happen, but it's grounded in the preservation of relationships. It's grounded in, again, these shared values. So there's preservation and novelty both happening, which is what you're describing in the Broadway show.
And one of the things that, because you and I both have done work with groups for some years now, and one of the things that is important to me, and I imagine it's important to you, and I'd love to hear you speak about, is as most of my own personal spiritual work was done in groups. And looking back over the years, I mean, like you, I spent many, many hours meditating, the vast majority of which were done in groups. A very small minority of my hours of meditation were done on my own,
Same.
individually. They were mostly done in groups, and I know that there's an effect of doing that kind of work together. And I also know that it's important in any spiritual work, but definitely in group work, for there to be some overarching context. In other words, why are we doing this work? Because sometimes it's almost like the context becomes the group, and we lose track of the fact that this is part of a bigger picture. And I would love to hear you talk about the bigger picture of working in groups.
Right now, I am every other year I facilitate a 7-month program it's called the Real Life Facilitator Program. And ostensibly what I'm teaching people are facilitation skills, but it's based on the assumption that we become better facilitators through becoming much more in touch with ourselves and with others. In other words, you can't know what to do with a group of people unless you're really open to the information that's coming into you. And a lot of that's coming through your own body. And well, it's all coming through your own mind. So we have to, I really support people being in touch with that. What I notice in response to your question about the greater context is that people come in wanting to become fundamentally more effective and a little more daring in the work that they're doing with people. They want to feel that they have more freedom to be who they really are and bring themselves forward. So there is this individual motive. But when we're in the room together, what we discover and part of what we talk about a lot is the greater context for our work, what we have in common in terms of the evolution of culture. And I think a lot of us feel at this time, particularly, that this really dreadful polarization and the way in which the internet is feeds a lot of that polarization, and the challenges that we have currently, even bringing groups of people together, because the politics are so divisive. So the sense that we have that we may they my participants may come with a personal motive. During the course of it, because of what we talk about and how we engage, we're always relating to a larger context, either the context of the local communities that they're working in, what's happening in their state or in the country. And then ultimately, we're a global species. I mean, we really the internet is connected. There's no going back from that. There are lots of and I know this is true for you that you work in very multicultural environments in which the value set and the aspirations and the goals are the same. And it always surprises us because why should it be that an Israeli and a Russian and someone from Latin America and somebody from the African continent and Europe and the States, how is it that we all have the same values and we're headed in the same direction with what we're trying to accomplish, which is greater depth of relationship, sustainability, and a focus on a future for human beings. There are lots of, as everybody who's listening to this and reading your article knows that the existential threats are all around us. And we can't help it if we feel them in relationship to climate change, we feel them in terms of how our politics have become destabilized and so divisive, as I've been saying, just the perniciousness of the arms deals. There's so many threats, another pandemic, for example. So we should be able to move from an I-centered view to a we-centered view to all of us, to all of it, because our survival depends on our relationship to the planet itself. So I think this view that we should be able to move scales together from our own independent, because each of the people in this course, they're looking for a kind of individual freedom as well. And again, I think I really support that, because when individuals feel free, groups feel free. So I really support the independent identity, but then dropping that identity is also very critical. So up and down the scale is what I would say.
I love what you just said. You talked about deepening relationship, sustainability, and looking toward a human future as kind of the overarching. I mean, it's beautifully stated, overarching context. I mean, that's what we want. What's interesting to me about collective work, and this is reflective of what you just said, is even more than individual spiritual work, which I am very deeply devoted to individual spiritual work as well. Collective spiritual work or collective transformational work, kind of almost more readily lends itself to the development of human relationship and human culture because we're doing it together. It sort of already focuses you on how we can be better together.
Yeah. Well, that's because that's where our problem is with each other. I mean, so I read a statistic, Jeff, that 50% of American households are single people that live alone. And our evolutionary nature is, we know our survival came in groups of whatever, 60 to 150 or whatever it was, and that we very naturally thrive in communities if we have the skill set to thrive in communities, because we're a social whole, and like it, our evolutionary histories, we belong in groups, and then there's this loneliness crisis that we know. And when we think about the climate, I've heard a friend of mine say, the problem isn't the climate, you know, humans will adapt, we'll figure that out, but it's what we do to one another when we're under stress. And you know, you think about it, any of the challenges that we face, the problem isn't the challenge. The problem is that we don't know how to work together at scale. And that's really what you're talking about, is our sets of shared interests, that there's still such rivalrous habits and dominant habits of domination and submission, and habits of, you know, zero sum. There couldn't possibly enough be enough. Though that's where our struggle is. There's almost nothing that could be solved if we could work together better. So that's, you know, that's the heart of the matter. And all of us do well on the cushion, even sitting in groups. But when we get off the cushion and we have to interact together and make decisions together and start to experiencing one up, one down, and rivalrousness, and feeling that, you know, maybe you belong to a certain group of people who isn't seen and heard properly, there's all sorts of things that arise. So those things interest me. You know, how do we actually liberate ourselves when those things arise?
Absolutely. Now, you said you talked about increasing scale. People can speak about that in different ways. But when we're talking about increasing scale, we're almost inevitably talking about sort of expanding consciousness. You know, when we expand, if we want to expand the scale in of which we are operating, we have to expand the consciousness within which we're working. And one of the powerful things that happens in groups, and I think one of the great values of transformational groups is the emergence of, there's different words for it, but I've heard you talk about it as collective intelligence that can awaken in a group. You have this beautiful, I got this from one of your other interviews, a beautiful definition for collective intelligence that it is the capacity of a group to function optimally, holistically, and compassionately for the well-being of the whole.
I said, great. I didn't realize I said that. That's great.
I heard it and I stopped. I had to rewind and write it down exactly the way you said it.
Well,
It's a different way of saying what you said before, deepening relationships, sustainability, and eye on the future. This time it's the capacity to function optimally, holistically, and compassionately for the well-being of the whole. I would love to know, what have you seen? Like, what have some of the most, or one of the most, profound experiences of collective intelligence arising in groups?
I have seen so many beautiful things happen when groups trust one another enough to let what needs to happen unfold. And I think that, let me just sit, because that's such an important question that you're asking. I've seen polarity shifts, and people suddenly start to argue the point for the other side. I've seen groups switch up roles. You know, we have all these conventions around oppressor and persecutor, and I've seen groups be able to shift it up so that compassion arises for a German in a room where you think it can't. Or males are suddenly listened to in a way that, you know, just all the challenges of being a male these days are out on the table, and there's such vulnerability and awareness and presence. And again, all the one up, one down dynamics of gender just go out the window. I've seen conversations where, you know, issues of blackness and, you know, white supremacy arise in a room, and because of the trust, I've seen people of color challenge each other and reverse course and really want to hear more from whites and feel really valued and come alive because they're able to receive, and that the narrative is not true, but it's all the narrative of white oppression is not untrue. But there are other truths that are simultaneously arising. I've seen so many moments of, you know, all of a sudden everything is different and it's free. There's a freedom in the room, and there's just a natural leaning in and a natural wakefulness. Nobody's bored. Like, everybody is the same consciousness as you talk about in that moment. You know, that can happen in a spiritual setting where, you know, there's a moving kind of prayer and everyone's consciousness becomes the same. We've had that experience so many times, you know, that we know it's true and we know we're capable of it. And my own personal bet is it's more available to us when we get to the point that we can start to own shadow, we can start to work with our rivalrous nature, we can see how our self-centeredness comes up. I tend to be in the school of let's integrate those things rather than try to get rid of them. You know, that there's no getting rid of them. Let them inform us and let things transform, as opposed to we're gonna, you know, block parts of who we are out because, you know, we're complex. So.
Yes, definitely. Now, you said earlier, and I don't remember if this is before or after we started recording, but you talked about how you and I both have some draw some background from integral theory. And when you're talking about the kinds of flips that you see in groups, what that makes me think of is part of this movement into what we could call a collective intelligence has to do with increased ability for perspective taking. And I would love to hear you talk about that, because I know it's something that you do talk about and support people with.
I want to say one thing before I do that, Jeff, and that is that when human beings taste oneness and when they taste the expansiveness of consciousness, whether it's in a traditional setting like a church or whether it's, you know, one half of the stadium in a football game or whether it's, you know, a moment where very spontaneously across the world something becomes a shared vision or shared reality. We all have those fleeting moments. It's absolutely recognizable by every human being at every wave of development across cultures. Like, it's so important that everybody understand how inherent it is that because we are not separate from reality and because we're not separate from each other fundamentally, that the recognition of that can happen in all kinds of settings with all kinds of groups of people. And that's what gives me hope because we all have that experience. In terms of perspective taking, I mean, it really is a, you know, according to the adult development that I've been exposed to, our capacity to take perspectives does grow and change. You know, there's a relative truth to that, meaning that some people can not take their own first person perspective. Maybe they've been abused, or perhaps they've been raised in a context in which there's never been value to their voice, and so they literally can't speak from the I position. You know, then you have people who can speak from I and literally can't even make it to you. Like, that's just impossible. And, you know, we would talk about those folks as really somehow thwarted in their development in terms of not having secure capacity to grow beyond their own first person. So pretty much all their energy is around securing and emboldening themselves. You know, we all know of examples of that. We have those folks in our family, there's a truncated development there for sure. And then you have people who are very good at I and you. You know, they can take that next step and be interested. I'm interested in learning from you. Just talking right now, your you is more important to me than my I, because I'm hearing things in ways that is expanding the way that I think, as we talked about earlier. I'm learning because of the you here, not because of the I. You know, the I is tired. The you is fresh. So that's a big deal. And then you have people who can do I, you, it, and they can, you know, in my work as a mediator, they can look at an appraisal and make sense of it. They know how the law is going to impact an outcome in a case. They understand that facts and law matter. Then you have people who are able to take even more complex perspectives. And a couple of considerations: time. Can you look to the past? Can you see to the future? Some people can't do that very well. They tend to be stuck in the past and can't envision. Other people, all they have are ideas, ideation, and they can't create reference points that include and create the depth of continuity, you could say. Ken would say, you know, we have fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth perspectives, and that fewer and fewer people can take more perspectives. But I think what's really important in this consideration is that there is a bright line in developmental theory. And when people reach a pluralistic level of development or wave of development, it's probably better sometimes not to make it so hierarchical, but then taking multiple perspectives actually comes up very naturally in their experience. We want to hear from another group of people. We want to take a different point of view. But what's important is that pluralistic, and you see this a lot in social justice work, there's a lot of practice of inclusion and multiple perspective taking, but it isn't achieved. It's not accomplished. So it collapses into one ideology and one perspective. And then what you have is what we call in the that I've learned from Ken is the second tier. And integral would be, or, you know, systems theory, and would be the first stage of that. And that is actually the first time in the literature, as I understand it, that we see people able to actually manage the tension in their body and in relationship with one another of multiple perspectives. Because when it first starts to arise, it's a stretch. And all of us watch how, when we're under stress, we start collapsing into fewer and fewer points of view. So the more the relaxation, the more the ability to expand, the more the threat, the less the ability to take points of view. And boom, you know, America goes from a modern pluralistic culture to deeply traditional under threat. So this is really important to understand, because when we're able to start to really take multiple points of view, then what happens is we struggle with how to prioritize them. So a kind of moral relativism sets in. So the next developmental thing is to be able to, now we can take multiple perspectives and tolerate the tension. The next thing is, how do we rank them? We can't just swim in as, and this is where, in order to take multiple perspectives, you have to collapse hierarchy. You can't stack hierarchies. You have to collapse it to create room for all these views to come in, but then you drown in them. So then you have to learn again how to prioritize perspectives. But the final and most important developmental task related to perspective taking is the ability to take a perspective on your own perspective. That's breakthrough. Because as soon as you can do that, you're now in the open field of awareness, watching perspectives arise, including your own, and your attachment and your ideological fixation and your self-esteem and your sense of embodied security is now completely liberated, liberated from those.
No, that is so powerful. The ability to take perspective on your own perspective, right? So it's the
Major break.
ability to step out of yourself in a sense, to be able to see the perspective you're taking at any given moment and be able to make some assessment of the validity of that and the value of that. That's a very
Which is
profound
another
state.
moment where trustable community becomes really important. We're talking about, transformation in groups. And when you step out of your own perspective, one of the things that can happen is immediate confusion. As soon as even if you've kind of mastered having multiple perspectives, when you step away from your own perspective, you can be destabilized. And so I need you to be able to. I need to be able to trust you so that I can feel the freedom of letting go of my own point of view. I can't do that in a room of people that I don't have some bond, like real bond with, where I can be stabilized in a certain way just by touching my shoulder or letting me know it's okay while I experience the disorientation of that. That's one of the most important things about doing this in groups, is that when we get destabilized, confused, disoriented, which always happens in when we're growing, we always have that moment where we don't quite know what's happening. And I need to be able to look around the room and see people that do know what's happening and know that I'm the one that doesn't, because I'm the one that's growing right now. That experience is intense,
Yes, now this is beautiful because in a transformational group, part of the dynamic that occurs, whatever size group it is, if you are working together over time, there's always going to be different points where different people are the ones who are letting go, right? So,
Absolutely. And it's really amazing how different it is, right? How it changes.
yes. And that's what happens is we get, I mean, one of the things that really happens in a transformational group is we come to the edge of our perspective. We come to the edge beyond which our perspective can no longer serve us. We need to let it go.
We come to the edge of our perspective.
Yes. And then we have to take the dive. And not everybody can take the dive at once, because like you said, some people have to be the field that holds, that creates the safety for others to let go. And that's a service we do to each other in transformational groups.
Absolutely.
Very powerful.
In a way, it just happened, because this is another thing I think that we should mention before. Kind of synchronicities and magic that happens when intentional. It's faith building. It's like there's something bigger going on, and we belong to it, and it supports us. But just now, my son's alarm goes off, and there's my husband, who's there, so I'm able to let go into this while that's being stabilized and taken care of. Like, that's what we do for each other. It's really important.
So, in one of the podcasts I listened to that you did, you spoke about the emergence of one mind in groups. And that focus was a big part of collective work I did over many years. You define the emergence of one mind as the individual's awareness of being completely continuous. And I thought, I would, first of all, just love to hear you speak about that because it's such a striking definition, but then mainly, and this is very practical. There's lots of people in the circles that work with me that are in groups that have the emergence of one mind as part of what they're looking for, and there are people who are emerging as facilitators of groups of that sort. And I would love to get any advice you have for people who are both participating in those kinds of groups, toward emergence of one mind, and people who are facilitating those groups, because it's tricky
Very tricky.
group work.
It's very tricky. Yeah. So in my training in this is in meditation, in the recognition of one heart, one mind, let's say Xin in Chinese, one great heart, great mind, Dai Xin, is really from the Zen tradition. So the way that I talk about it is culturally determined in that way. And we use the word to recognize. And what is emergent is our ability to recognize one mind and to feel it. And to, when we recognize it together, it's more powerful than when we recognize it alone. But this awakening to this experience of non-separation, where what I'm experiencing and what you're experiencing, when you and I are both identified as Diane and Jeff, we have a very dynamic back and forth. When we both identify as awareness, for example, in this moment, then suddenly we're the same, because what you're aware of and what I'm aware of constitute one thing. And this opening to be able to see what this is the most radical sameness. And it's our individual identity that interrupts that. And so the discipline in the group, of course, is to look for that emergence, that recognition, and to deepen it so that it doesn't drop away, so that we become, in Zen, we would say we function from a mind that is not one, not two, that we're able to always feel and experience the oneness, even as we're engaged with the particular, but we don't get hijacked by self. Well, let's just say we don't get over hijacked or too frequently hijacked by self-identity, because it's self-identity that interferes with our experience of oneness. And my teacher, my Zen teacher, Genpo Roshi, who introduced me to Ken Wilber, and that's how I became connected to Ken and how I met you, Jeff, and Andrew, in your community. He used a process called the Big Mind Process, where he facilitated people into experiencing open awareness together, into experiencing the mind of one, he would say, into experiencing big mind or big heart, and just get helping people swim in that deeper water. Because it's very threatening. This is the thing we need to understand, and those of us who've practiced for a long time know how that experience of openness, of non-separation, of non-defensiveness, of continuity, of boundlessness, the sensations of calm, of peace that arise, that come up with that, compassion naturally arises when all things are as they are, not separate. That is very threatening to our individual identity. So part of the challenge for your facilitators is to become so used to that experience in themselves that they can feel it in the room, and they can invite it into the room. And then when any individual egoic nature is threatened by that expansiveness, to help to calm that nervous system, to help them extend their senses, to relax, because relaxation is key to this experience. And we're so habituated to guarding and protect our individual selves that we literally just block this obviousness all the time. So I know that you guys have had a different method for doing it. What's been your experience of what your facilitators need to learn to be able to bring a room into that kind of wholeness and freedom?
Well, I guess what I would say is, I think, as I said earlier, it's important to have to really stay connected to an overarching goal for what's the context within which this gathering is taking place, so that it stays connected to these greater possibilities. I think also, and I've heard you speak about this, but there's a skill in reading the field. I love that you speak about this somatically because it's often a very embodied feeling of how is the field cohering, and then how, when is it kind of
Very
wobbling?
sensitive to coherence and differentiation. You can feel everyone's the same mind, and then so and so they're having a thought, and
Yes.
they're feeling it, but they're not aware they're feeling it, but they're thinking at the same time. We're so sensitive, we can pick all this up, but we need training.
Yes. But that ability to read the field is so crucial, and I love what you said earlier, because I think this is also true. It in the facilitation of groups, maybe more important than anything else, you have to be holding the space in yourself that is the space in which the oneness emerges, and that can be very difficult. And then I think there's other skills that need to be learned in terms of, and I'm sure you do a lot of this because I as a mediator, I'm sure a wealth of your background, ways of, like you said, if someone's identity is being threatened in some way, there are skillful ways to support them to relax, and there are unskillful ways to support people that aren't supportive at all. And those are skills that need to be learned.
I
And
agree.
I assume that's a big part of what you train people in your facilitation trainings. And I guess if I was boiling it down, to me, it feels like a grounding in love is so important. A sense of just care and concern for the well-being. You said it in your definition, for the well-being of this group, and really emotionally being connected to wanting this to work out. Because as I understand it, okay, so I did this weekend workshop some years ago, and the person leading it, the facilitator, defined an adult as the person in any given situation who's committed to making it work. And they said, in this workshop, I need this to be a workshop of adults so that we're all committed to making this work. And that's what I think is so important in any group work. Everyone has to be coming from a place where they want this to work, not just work for them, but they want the group to work. They want this group to become everything that it can be, knowing that if that happens, they will benefit the most personally. But really inspiring people's concern to be on the well-being of the whole. How can we really make this work together?
Well, I love that you brought the word love in. I mean, that was actually enlivening to me just to hear about that, and that you're building, in a way, you're building a container of care, and that an adult is defined as someone who is the most committed in any moment to making this work. But we need all adults in the room. And that question of how do we, because there's a little bit of a norm in postmodern America that the one with the conflict gets the attention. The one who has the problem with what's happening, the one who's going to call out something that's not being seen or heard. And I'm in favor of working with shadow and calling out hypocrisies and those kind of things. But again, they have to be subsumed into this idea that we're going to make this a good experience for everybody, and that well-being is our goal. Because coming into a group that basically gets its will in a ditch, and then everyone's stuck and nobody can move, and it's somebody's fault and it's everybody's fault, I think we've all been in those. And though, there's a there, I mean, the universities are just, rife with those experiences. Like, that's happening all over, and we just need to help people step out of that. I mean, that's one of the things I really try to help people with, is what do you do in groups that get stuck in a really postmodern quality of subjectivity and conflict they can't work themselves out of. So one thing in my groups that I learned from a person who is a consultant who did EST in the early days, is his ground rule, his number one ground rule, is that we're going to be for each other. And I adopted that ground rule from him, because I found that agreement, that even though in any moment if I'm stressed or if I feel a conflict, that I'm going to lose capacity to remember that I love you. I'm going to lose that because that's the nature of the physiology. Back to talking about the nervous system, the physiology, it interrupts memory, it interrupts clear thinking. All of, where the experience in the body is that there's danger and that we need to seek cover or, fight for who we are or whatever it happens to be. But we can entrain being for each other even as we're having that experience of not liking someone else. Or a feeling really separate from somebody. So, and then building on those moments where energy is just flowing really freely and it's so clear that everyone loves each other. I mean, what an awesome experience. We should be devoted to giving people more of that in life. I mean, we all need to feel more love. I just appreciate the number of times that you gave me a shout out for something I said. It's like, I just feel better because you're nice to me.
Yeah, of course. And absolutely. And we also, people like us, we do this work. We like to know that it actually has an effect, you know, because
Precisely.
oftentimes it kind of goes out into the ether and you assume it has an effect, but it's nice to get some report back that it actually did.
Yes, it matters. And people's lives are changed. They say that,
Yes, absolutely. Diane, thank you so much. I think we'll end our interview part there.